Side 4, Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 107. What can young Osby possibly have in mind? He is carefully scraping out the inside of each persimmon-colored mushroom cup and shredding the rest. Dispossessed elves run around up on the roof, gibbering. He now has a growing heap of orange-gray fungus, which he proceeds to add in fistfuls to a pot of steaming water. A previous batch also simmers atop the stove, reduced to a thick gruel covered with yellow scum, which Osby now removes and purees further in Pirate's blending machine. Then he spreads the fungoid mush over a tin cookie sheet. He opens the oven, removes with asbestos potholders another sheet covered with dark caked dust, and replaces it with the one he has just prepared. With a mortar and pestle, he pulverizes the substance and dumps it into an old Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin, reserving only enough to roll deftly up in a Ritzler licorice cigarette paper, light and inhale the smoke of. But she happens to have glanced in just at the instant Osby opened the echoing oven. The camera records no change in her face. But why does she stand now so immobile at the door, as if the frame were to be stopped and prolonged into just such a lengthwise moment of gold, fresh and tarnished, innocence microscopically masked, her elbow slightly bent, hand resting against the wall, fingers fanned on the pale orange paper as if she touches her own skin. A pensive touch. Outside, the long rain in silicon and freezing descent smacks desolate, slowly corrosive against the medieval windows, curtaining like smoke the river's far shore. This city, in all its bomb-pierced miles, this inexhaustibly knotted victim, skin of glistening roof slates, sotted brick flooded high about each window, dark or lit, each of a million openings vulnerable to the gloom of this winter day. The rain washes, drenches, fills the gutters, singing. The city receives it, lifting in a perpetual shrug. With a squeak and metal slam, the oven is closed again, but for Katya, it will never close. She has posed before the mirrors too often today. Knows her hair and makeup are perfect, admires the frock they have brought her from Harvey Nichols, a sheer crepe that flows in from padded shoulders down to a deep point between her breasts, a rich cocoa shade, known as nigger in this country, yards and yards of this delicious silk spun and thrown, tied loosely at the waist, soft pleats falling to her knees. The cameraman is pleased at the unexpected effect of so much flowing crepe, particularly when Katya passes before a window and the rain light coming through changes it for a few brief unshutterings to murky glass, charcoal-saturated, antique and weather-worn, frock, face, hair, hands, slender calves all gone to glass and glazing for the celluloid instant poised. The translucent guardian of a rainfall, shaken through all day by rocket blasts near and far, downward, dark and ruinous behind her, the ground, which, for the frame's passage, defines her. At the images she sees in the mirror, Katya also feels a cameraman's pleasure, but knows what he cannot, that inside herself, enclosed in the soigné surface of dear fabric and dead cells, she is corruption and ashes. She belongs, in a way none of them can guess, cruelly to the oven, to Der Kinderofen, remembering now his teeth, long, terrible, veined with bright brown rot as he speaks these words, the yellow teeth of Captain Blissero, the network of stained cracks, and back in his night breath in the dark oven of himself, always the coiled whispers of decay. She recalls his teeth before any other feature. Teeth were to benefit most directly from the oven, from what is planned for her and for Gottfried. He never uttered it clearly as threat, nor ever addressed to either of them directly, but rather across her trained satin thighs to the evening's guests, or down the length of Gottfried's docile spine. The Rome-Berlin axis, he called it. The night the Italian came and they were all on the round bed, Captain Blissero plugged into Gottfried's upended asshole, and the Italian at the same time into his pretty mouth. Katya only passive, bound and gagged and false-eyelashed, serving tonight as human pillow for the Italian's whitening, perfumed curls, roses and fat just at the edge of turning rancid. Each utterance a closed flower, capable of exfoliation and infinite revealing. She thinks of a mathematical function that will expand for her bloom-like into a power series with no general term, endlessly, darkly, though never completely by surprise. His phrase, Padre Ignacio, unfolding into Spanish Inquisitor, black robes, brown arching nose, the suffocating smell of incense plus confessor slash executioner, plus Katya and Gottfried both kneeling, side by side in dark confessional, plus children out of old Märchen kneeling, knees cold and aching before the oven, whispering to it secrets they can tell no one else, plus Captain Blissero's witch paranoia, suspecting them both. Katya, despite her NSB credentials, plus the oven as listener slash avenger, plus Katya kneeling before Blissero in highest drag, black velvet and Cuban heels, his penis squashed invisible under a flesh-colored leather jockstrap, over which he wears a false cunt and merkin of sable, both handcrafted in Berlin by the notorious Madame Ophir, the mock labia and bright purple clitoris molded of, Madame had been abject pleading shortages, synthetic rubber and mypolam, the new polyvinyl chloride. Tiny blades of stainless steel bristle from lifelike pink humidity. Hundreds of them, against which Katya, kneeling, is obliged to cut her lips and tongue, and then kiss blood abstracts across the golden, ungessoed back of her brother, Gottfried. Brother in play, in slavery. She had never seen him before coming to the requisitioned house near the firing sites, hidden in the woods and parkland of this settled tongue of small farms and estates that reaches eastward from the royal city. Between two expanses of polder toward Wassenaar, yet his face, for that first time, seen in autumn sunlight through the great west window of the drawing room, kneeling naked except for a studded dog collar, masturbating metronomic at shouted commands from Captain Blissero, all his fair skin stained by afternoon a luminous synthetic orange she has never before associated with skin. His penis a blood monolith, its thickly gasping mouth audible in the carpeted silence, his face raised to none of them, but as if to something on the ceiling or in the sky which ceilings may in his vision stand for. Eyes down, as he seems most of the time to be, his face ascending, tightening, coming, is so close to what she's been seeing all her life in mirrors, her own studied mannequin's stare, that she catches her breath, feels for a moment the speeded percussion of her heart, before just such a stare toward Blissero. He is delighted. Perhaps, he tells her, I will cut your hair. He smiles at Gottfried. Perhaps I'll have him grow his. The humiliation would be good for the boy each morning at quarters, ranked with his battery near Schussstelle 3, where horses thundered once before the frantic, the losing railbirds of the old peace, failing inspections time after time, yet protected by his captain from army discipline. Instead, between firings, day or night, short of sleep, odd hours, suffering the captain's own Hexersüchtigung. But did Blissero also cut her hair? She can't remember now. She knows she wore Gottfried's uniforms once or twice, pushing her hair, yes, up under his forage cap, looking easily his double, spending these nights in the cage, as Blissero has set the rules, while Gottfried must wear her silk stockings, her lace apron and cap, all her satin and her ribboned organdy. But afterward, he must always go back again to the cage. That's how it is. Their captain allows no doubt as to which brother or sister really is maidservant and which fattening goose. How seriously is she playing? In a conquered country, one's own occupied country, it's better, she believes, to enter into some formal, rationalized version of what outside proceeds without form or decent limit day and night. The summary executions, the roustings, beatings, subterfuge, paranoia, shame, though it is never discussed among them openly. It would seem Katya, Gottfried, and Captain Blissereau have agreed that this northern and ancient form, one they all know and are comfortable with, the strayed children, the wood life in the edible house, the captivity, the fattening, the oven, shall be their preserving routine, their shelter, against what outside none of them can bear, the war, the absolute rule of chance, their own pitiable contingency here, in its midst. It isn't safe, even inside, in the house. Nearly every day a rocket misfires. Late in October, not far from this estate, one fell back and exploded, killing 12 of the ground crew, breaking windows for hundreds of meters all around, including the west window of the drawing room where Katya first saw her golden game brother. The official rumor stated that only fuel and oxidizer had gone off. But Captain Blissereau, with a trembling, she must say nihilistic pleasure, said that the Amatol charge in the warhead had also exploded, making them as much target as launch site. That they were all condemned. The house lies west of the Dundicht racecourse, quite the other direction from London, but no bearing is exempt. Often the rockets, crazed, turn at random, whinnying terribly in the sky, turn about and fall according each to its madness, so unreachable and, it is feared, incurable. When there's time to, their owners destroy them, by radio, in mid-convulsion. Between rocket launches there are the English raids. Spitfires come roaring in low over the dark sea at supper time, the searchlights in the city staggering on. The afterhum of sirens hangs in the sky high above the wet iron seats in the parks. The AA guns chug, searching, and the bombs fall in woodland, in polder, among flats thought to be billeting rocket troops. It adds an overtone to the game, which changes the timbre slightly. It is she who, at some indefinite future moment, must push the witch into the oven intended for Gottfried. So the captain must allow for the real chance she's a British spy, or member of the Dutch underground. Despite all German efforts, intelligence inputs still flow from Holland back to RAF Bomber Command in a steady torrent, telling of deployments, supply routes, of which dark green crumble of trees may hide an A4 emplacement. Data changing hour to hour, so mobile are the rockets and their support equipment. But the Spitfires will settle for a power station, a liquid oxygen supply, a battery commander's billet. That's the intriguing question. Will Katya feel her obligation cancelled by someday calling down English fighter bombers on this very house, her game's prison, though it mean death? Captain Blissereau can't be sure. Up to a point he finds the agony delightful. Certainly her record with Mussert's people is faultless. She's credited with smelling out at least 3 crypto-Jewish families. She attends meetings faithfully. She works at a Luftwaffe resort near Scheveningen, where her superiors find her efficient and cheerful, no shirker. Nor, like so many of them, using party fanaticism to cover a lack of ability. Perhaps there's the only shadow of warning. Her commitment is not emotional. She appears to have reasons for being in the party. A woman with some background in mathematics and with reasons. Want the change, Rilke said. Oh, be inspired by the flame. To laurel, to nightingale, to wind, wanting it, to be taken, to embrace, to fall toward the flame, growing to fill all the senses and not to love because it was no longer possible to act, but to be helplessly in a condition of love. But not Katya. No moth-like plunge. He must conclude that secretly she fears the change, choosing instead only trivially to revise what matters least. Ornament and clothing. going no further than politic transvestism, not only in Gottfried's clothing, but even in traditional masochist uniform, the French maid outfit so inappropriate to her tall, long-legged stride, her blondness, her questing shoulders like wings. She plays at this only, plays at playing. He can do nothing. Among dying Reich, orders lapsing to paper impotence, he needs her so, needs Gottfried, the straps and whips leathern, real in his hands which still feel her cries, the red welts across the boy's buttocks, their mouths, his penis, fingers and toes. In all the winter these, are sure, can be depended on. He can give you no reason, but in his heart he trusts, perhaps only by now, in the form, this out of all Märchen und Sagen, trusts that this charmed house in the forest will be preserved. That no bombs could ever fall here by accident, only betrayal. Only if Katya really were a spotter for the English and bade them, and he knows she cannot. That through some magic, below the bone resonance of any words, a British raid is the one prohibited shape of all possible pushes from behind into the oven's iron and final summer. It will come. It will. His destiny. Not that way, but it will come. Und nicht einmal sein Schritt klingt aus dem tonlosen Los. Of all Rilke's poetry, it's this tenth elegy he most loves. Can feel the bitter lager of yearning begin to prickle behind eyes and sinuses at remembering any passage of. The newly dead youth, embracing his lament, his last link, leaving now even her marginally human touch forever, climbing all alone, terminally alone, up and up into the mountains of primal pain, with the wildly alien constellations overhead. And not once does his step ring from the soundless destiny. It's he, Blissero, who climbs the mountain, has been so climbing for nearly 20 years, since long before he embraced the Reich's flame, since Südwest alone. No matter what flesh was there to appease the witch, cannibal, and sorcerer, flourishing implements of pain, alone. Alone. He doesn't even know the witch. Can't understand the hunger that defines him slash her. He's only in times of weakness bewildered that it should coexist in the same body as himself. An athlete and his skill, separate awarenesses. Young Rauhandel at least had said so. How many years back into the piece? Blissero had watched his young friend, even then, already so blatantly, so pathetically doomed to some form of Eastern Front. Inside a bar, out in the street, wearing whatever tight or awkward suit, whatever fragile shoes, react in all grace to the football which jokers would, recognizing him, toss out of nowhere, the deathless performances. That one impromptu boot, so impossibly high, so perfectly parabolic, the ball soaring miles to pass exactly between the two tall phallic electric columns of the Ufa Theater and the Friedrichstrasse. The head control he could keep up for city blocks for hours, the feet articulate as poetry. Yet he could only shake his head, wanting to be a good fellow when they asked, but unable really to say, it happens. The muscles do it. Then recalling an old trainer's words, it's muscular. Smiling beautifully and already by the act, conscripted, already cannon fodder. The pale bar light across the grating of his close-shaved skull. It's reflexes, you see, not me, just the reflexes. When did it begin to change for Blissero among those days? From lust to simple sorrow. Dumb as Rauhandel's amazement with his own talent. He has seen so many of these Rauhandels, especially since 39, harboring the same mysterious guests, strangers, often no more bizarre than a gift for being always where shells were not. Do any of them, this raw material, want the change? Do they even know? He doubts it. Their reflexes are only being used. Hundreds of thousands at a time, by others, by royal moths, the flame has inspired. Blissero has lost, years ago, all his innocence on this question. So, his destiny is the oven. while the strayed children who never knew, who changed nothing but uniforms and cards of identity, will survive and prosper long beyond his gases and cinders, his chimney departure. So, Evandervogel in the mountains of pain. It's been going on for much too long. He has chosen the game for nothing if not the kind of end it will bring him, nicht wahr? To old these days, grips taking longer to pass, stomach too often in day-long agony, eyes measurably blinder with each examination, too realistic to prefer a hero's death or even a soldier's. He only wants now to be out of the winter, inside the oven's warmth, darkness, steel shelter, the door behind him in a narrowing rectangle of kitchen light, gonging shut forever. The rest is foreplay. Yet he cares more than he should, and puzzled that he does, about the children, about their motives, he gathers it is their freedom they look for, yearningly as he for the oven, and such perversity haunts and depresses him. He returns again and again to the waste and senseless image of what was a house in the forest, reduced now to crumbs and sugar smears. The black, indomitable oven, all that remains. And the two children, the peak of sweet energy behind them, hunger beginning again, wandering away into a green blankness of trees. Where will they go? Where shelter the nights? The improvidence of children, and the civil paradox of this their little state, whose base is the same oven which must destroy it. But every true God must be both organizer and destroyer. Brought up into a Christian ambience, this was difficult for him to see until his journey to Sudvest, until his own African conquest. Among the abrading fires of the Kalahari, under the broadly sheeted coastal sky, fire and water, he learned. The Herero boy, long tormented by missionaries into a fear of Christian sins, jackal ghosts, potent European strand wolves pursuing him, seeking to feed on his soul. The precious worm that lived along his backbone now tried to cage his old gods, snare them in words, give them away, savage, paralyzed, to this scholarly white who seemed so in love with language. Carrying in his kit a copy of the Duino elegies, just off the presses when he embarked for Sudvest, a gift from mother at the boat, the odor of new ink dizzying his nights as the old freighter plunged tropic after tropic, until the constellations, like the new stars of Painland, had become all unfamiliar and the Earth's seasons reversed, and he came ashore in a high-powered wooden boat that had 20 years earlier brought blue-trousered troops in from the iron roadstead to crush the great Herero Rising. To find, back in the hinterland, up in an outstretch of broken mountains, between the Namib and the Kalahari, his own faithful native, his night flower. An impassable waste of rock blasted at by the sun. Miles of canyons twisting nowhere. Drifted at the bottoms with white sand turning a cold, queenly blue as the afternoons lengthened. "We make Njambi Karunga now, Omuhona." A whisper across the burning thorn branches, where the German conjures away energies present outside the firefight with his slender book. He looks up in alarm. The boy wants to fuck. But he is using the Herero name of God. An extraordinary chill comes over the white man. He believes, like the Rhenish missionary society who corrupted this boy, in blasphemy. Especially out here in the desert where dangers he can't bring himself to name, even in cities, even in daylight, gather about, wings folded, buttocks touching the cold sand, waiting. Tonight he feels the potency of every word. Words are only an eye-twitch away from the things they stand for. The peril of buggering the boy under the resonance of the sacred name fills him insanely with lust. Lust in the face, the mask of instant talion from outside the fire. But to the boy, Njambi Karunga is what happens when they couple, that's all. God is creator and destroyer, sun and darkness, all sets of opposites brought together, including black and white, male and female, and he becomes, in his innocence, the Jambi Karunga's child, as are all his preterite clan, relentlessly beyond their own history. Here, underneath the European's sweat, ribs, gut muscles, cock, the boy's own muscles staying fiercely tight for what seems hours, as if he intends to kill, but not a word, only the long, clonic, thick slices of night that pass over their bodies. What did I make of him? Captain Blissero knows that the African at this moment is halfway across Germany, deep in the Harz, and that, should the oven this winter close behind him, why they have already said Auf Wiedersehen for the last time. He sits stomach crawling, glands stuffed with malaise, bowed over the console inside the swarm-painted launch control car. The sergeants at motor and steering panels are out taking a cigarette break. He's alone at the controls. Outside, through the dirty periscope, gnarled fog unloosens from the bright zone of frost that belly bands the reared and shadowy rocket with the liquid oxygen tanks being topped off. Trees press close. Overhead, you see barely enough sky for the rocket's ascent. The Bodenplatte, concrete plate laid over strips of steel, is set inside a space defined by three trees, blazed so as to triangulate the exact bearing, 260 degrees, to London. The symbol used is a rude mandala, a red circle with a thick black cross inside, recognizable as the ancient sun wheel from which tradition says the swastika was broken by the early Christians to disguise their outlaw symbol. Two nails are driven into the tree at the center of the cross. Next to one of the painted blaze marks, the most westerly, someone has scratched in the bark with the point of a bayonet the words, "In hoc signo vinces." No one in the battery will admit to this act. Perhaps it is the work of the underground, but it has not been ordered removed. Pale yellow stump tops wink around the Bodenplatte. Fresh chips and sawdust mix with older fallen leaves. The smell, childlike, deep, is confused by petrol and alcohol. Rain threatens, perhaps today, snow. The crews move nervously, gray-green. Shiny black India rubber cables snake away into the forest to connect the ground equipment with the Dutch grid's 380 volts. Erwartung. For some reason, he finds it harder these days to remember. What is framed, dirt blurry in the prisms, the ritual, the daily iteration inside these newly cleared triangles in the forests, has taken over what used to be memory's random walk, its innocent image gathering. His time away with Katja and Gottfried has become shorter and more precious as the tempo of firings quickens. Though the boy is in Blissero's unit, the captain hardly sees him when they're on duty, a flash of gold helping the surveyors chain the kilometers out to the transmitting station, the guttering brightness of his hair in the wind, vanishing among trees. How strangely opposite to the African, a color negative, yellow and blue. The captain, in some sentimental overflow, some precognition, gave his African boy the name Enzian, after Rilke's mountainside gentian of Nordic colors brought down like a pure word to the valleys. Bringt doch der Wanderer auch vom Hange des Bergrands nicht eine Handvoll Erde ins Tal, die alle unsägliche, sondern ein erworbenes Wort, reines, den gelben und blauen Enzian. Omuhona, look at me, I'm red and brown, black, Omuhona. Liebchen, this is the other half of the earth. In Germany, you would be yellow and blue. Mirror metaphysics. Self-enchanted by what he imagined elegance, his bookish symmetries. And yet why speak so purposeless to the arid mountain, the heat of the day, the savage flower from whom he drank so endlessly? Why lose those words into the mirage, the yellow sun and freezing blue shadows in the ravines? Unless it was prophesying, beyond all pre-disaster syndrome, beyond the terror of contemplating his middle age, however glancingly, however impossible the chance of any providing, beyond was something heaving, stirring, forever below, forever before his words. something then that could see a time coming terrible, at least as terrible as this winter and the shape to which the war has now grown. A shape making unavoidable the shape of one last jigsaw piece. This oven game, with the yellow-haired and blue-eyed youth and silent double-ganger Katya, who was her opposite number in Sudvest. What black girl he never saw, hidden always in the blinding sun. The hoarse and cindered passage of the trains at night, a constellation of dark stars no one, no Auntie Rilke had named. But 1944 was much too late for any of it to matter. Those symmetries were all pre-war luxury. Nothing's left him to prophesy. Least of all her sudden withdrawal from the game. The one variation he didn't provide for, perhaps indeed because he never saw the black girl either. Perhaps the black girl is a genius of meta-solutions, knocking over the chessboard, shooting the referee. But after the act of wounding, breaking, what's to become of the little oven state? Can't it be fixed? Perhaps a new form, one more appropriate. The archer and his son, and the shooting of the apple, yes, and the war itself as tyrant king. It can still be salvaged, can't it? Patched up, roles reassigned, no need to rush outside where... Gottfried in the cage watches her slip her bonds and go. Fair and slender, the hair on his legs only visible in sunlight and then as a fine, imponderable net of gold, his eyelids already wrinkling in oddly young-slash-old signatures, flourishes, the eyes a seldom-encountered blue that on certain days, in sync with the weather, is too much for these almond fringes and brims over, seeps, bleeds out to illuminate the boy's entire face. Virgin blue, drowned man blue, blue drawn so insatiably into the chalky walls of Mediterranean streets we quietly cycled through in noontimes of the old peace. He can't stop her. If the captain asks, he'll tell what he saw. Gottfried has seen her sneak out before, and there are rumors she's with the underground. She's in love with a Stuka pilot she met in Scheveningen. But she must love Captain Blissereau too. Gottfried styles himself a passive observer. He has waited for his present age and the conscription notice to catch him with an impudent terror like watching the inrush of a curve you mean to take for the first time in a controlled skid. Take me, gathering speed till the last possible moment. Take me, his good night's one prayer. The danger he thinks he needs is still fictional for him. In what he flirts and teases with, death is not a real outcome. The hero always walks out of the heart of the explosion, sooty-faced but grinning. The blast is noise and change, and diving for cover. Gottfried hasn't yet seen a stiff, not up close. He hears now and then from home that friends have died. He's watched long, flabby canvas sacks being handled in the distances into the poisoned gray of the trucks and the headlamps cutting the mist. But when the rockets fail and try to topple back on you who fired them, and a dozen of you press down, bodies jammed together in the slit trenches waiting, all sweat-stunk wool and tense with laughter held in, you only think, what a story to tell at mess, to write to Mutti. These rockets are his pet animals, barely domesticated, often troublesome, even apt to revert. He loves them in the way he would have loved horses or tiger tanks had he pulled duty somewhere else. Here he feels taken at true ease. Without the war, what could he have hoped for? But to be part of this adventure, if you cannot sing Siegfried, at least you can carry a spear. On what mountain slope, from what tanning and adored face did he hear that? All he remembers is the white sweep upward, the quilted meadows mobbed with cloud. Now he's learning a trade, tending the rockets. And when the war ends, he'll study to be an engineer. He understands that Blissereau will die or go away and that he will leave the cage, but he connects this with the end of the war, not with the oven. He knows, like everyone, that captive children are always freed in the moment of maximum danger. The fucking, the salt length of the captain's weary, often impotent penis pushing into his meek mouth, the stinging chastisements, his face reflected in the act of kissing the captain's boots, their shine mottled, corroded by bearing grease, oil, alcohol spilled and fueling, darkening his face to the one he can't recognize. These are necessary. They make specific his captivity, which otherwise would hardly be different from army stifling, army repression. He's ashamed that he enjoys them so much. The word bitch, spoken now in a certain tone of voice, will give him an erection he cannot will down, afraid that, if not actually judged and damned, he's gone insane. The whole battery knows of the arrangement. Though they still obey the captain, it's there in their faces, felt trembling out along the steel tape measures, splashing onto his tray at mess, elbowed into his right sleeve with each dressing of his squad. He dreams often these days of a very pale woman who wants him, who never speaks, but the absolute confidence in her eyes, his awful certainty that she, a celebrity everyone recognizes on sight, knows him and has no reason to speak to him beyond the beckoning that's in her face, sends him vibrating awake in the nights, the captain's exhausted face inches away across the silk of wrinkled silver, weak eyes staring as his own, whiskers he suddenly must scrape his cheek against, sobbing, trying to tell how she was, how she looked at him. The captain's seen her, of course. Who hasn't? His idea of comfort is to tell the child, she's real, you have no say in this, you must understand that she means to have you. No use screaming awake, bothering me this way. But if she comes back, submit, Gottfried, give it all up. See where she takes you. Think of the first time I fucked you, how tight you were, until you knew I meant to come inside. Your little rosebud bloomed. You had nothing, not even by then your mouth's innocence to lose. But the boy continues to cry. Katya won't help him. Perhaps she's asleep. He never knows. He wants to be her friend, but they hardly ever speak. She's cold, mysterious. He's jealous of her sometimes, and at others. Usually when he wants to fuck her, and through some ingenuity of the captain's cannot, at such times he thinks he loves her desperately. Unlike the captain, he has never seen her as the loyal sister who'll free him from the cage. He dreams that release, but as a dark exterior process that will happen, no matter what any of them may want. Whether she goes or stays. So, when Katya quits the game for good, he is silent. Blissero curses her. He flings a boot tree at a precious Terboch. Bombs fall to the west in the Hachschebosch. The wind blows, ruffling the ornamental ponds outside. Staff cars snarl away down the long drive lined with beeches. The half moon shines among hazy clouds, its dark half the color of aged meat. Blissero orders everyone down into the shelter. A cellar full of gin in brown crocks, open slat crates of anemone bulbs. The slut has put his battery in the British crosshairs. The raid can come at any moment. Everybody sits around drinking eau de genever and peeling cheeses, telling stories, mostly funny ones, from before the war. By dawn they're all drunk and sleeping. Scraps of wax litter the floor like leaves. No Spitfires come. But later that morning, Schussstelle 3 is moved, and the requisitioned house is abandoned, and she is gone. Crossed over the English lines, at the salient where the great airborne adventure lies bogged for the winter, wearing Gottfried's boots and an old dress, black moiré, calf-length, a size too large, dowdy. Her last disguise. From here on she will be Katya. The only debt outstanding is to Captain Prentice. The others, Piet, Wim, the drummer, the Indian, have all dropped her, left her for dead. Or else this is her warning that... Sorry, no, we need the bullet. Wim's face in shadows, her eye can't compensate for, bitterly whispering underneath the Scheveningen pier, ragged crowd footfalls on the wood overhead. Every fucking bullet we can get, we need the silence. We couldn't spare a man to get rid of the body. I've wasted 5 minutes with you already. So he will take up their last meeting with technical matters she can no longer share. When she looks around, he's gone, gorilla silent, and she has no way to bring this together with how he felt last year, for a while under the cool chenille, in the days before he got so many muscles. And the scars on shoulder and thigh, a late bloomer, a neutral man goaded finally past his threshold. But she'd loved him before that. She must have. She's worth nothing to them now. They were after Schussstelle 3. She gave them everything else, but kept finding reasons not to pinpoint the captain's rocket site, and there is too much doubt by now as to how good the reasons were. True, the site was often moved about, but she could have been placed no closer to the decision-making. It was her own expressionless servant's face that leaned in over their schnapps and cigars, the charts coffee-ringed across the low tables, the cream papers stamped purple as bruised flesh. Wim and the others have invested time and lives. 3 Jewish families sent east. Though, wait now, she's more than balanced it, hasn't she, in the months out at Scheveningen? They were kids, neurotic, lonely. Pilots and crews, they all loved to talk, and she's fed back who knows how many reams worth of most secret flimsies across the North Sea, hasn't she? Squadron numbers, fueling stops, spin recovery techniques and turning radii, power settings, radio channels, sectors, traffic patterns, hasn't she? What more do they want? She asks this seriously, as if there's a real conversion factor between information and lives. Well, strange to say, there is. Written down in a manual, on file at the War Department. Don't forget the real business of the war is buying and selling. The murdering and the violence are self-policing and can be entrusted to non-professionals. The mass nature of wartime death is useful in many ways. It serves as spectacle, as diversion from the real movements of the war. It provides raw material to be recorded into history, so that children may be taught history as sequences of violence, battle after battle, and be more prepared for the adult world. Best of all, mass deaths a stimulus to just ordinary folks, little fellows, to try and grab a piece of that pie while they're still here to gobble it up. The true war is a celebration of markets. Organic markets, carefully styled black by the professionals, spring up everywhere. Scrip, sterling, Reichsmarks continue to move, severe as classical ballet inside their antiseptic marble chambers. But out here, down here among the people, the truer currencies come into being. So, Jews are negotiable. Every bit as negotiable as cigarettes, Kant, or Hershey bars. Jews also carry an element of guilt, of future blackmail, which operates, Natch, in favor of the professionals. So Katya here is hollering into a silence, a North Sea of hopes, and Pirate Prentice, who knows her from hurried meetings in city squares that manage to be barracks-faced and claustrophobic, under dark softwood smells of staircases steep as ladders, on a gaff-rigger by an oily quay and a cat's amber eyes staring down. In a block of old flats with rain in the courtyard, and a bulky ancient Schwarzlose stripped to toggle links and oil pump littered about the dusty room, who has each time seen her as a face belonging with others he knows better, at the margin of each enterprise, now confronted with this face out of context, an enormous sky, all sea clouds in full march, tall and plumb behind her, detects danger in her loneliness, realizes he's never heard her name. Not till the meeting by the windmill known as the Angel. She tells him why she's alone, more or less, why she can't ever go back, and her face is somewhere else, painted on canvas, hung with other survivals back in the house near Dundicht, only witnessing the oven game, centuries passing like the empurpled clouds, darkening an infinitesimal layer of varnish between herself and Pirate, granting her the shield of serenity she needs, of classic irrelevance. But where will you go? Both of them, hands in pockets, scarves tightly wrapped, stones the water has left behind, shining black weight-like writing in a dream, about to make sense printed here along the beach, each fragment so amazingly clear, yet I don't know where would be a good place. The White Visitation, Pirate suggested. The White Visitation is fine, she said, and stepped into the void. Osby, have I gone mad? A snowy night. 5 rocket bombs since noon, shivering in the kitchen, late and candlelit. Osby, feel the house idiot savant so far into an encounter with Nutmeg this evening that the inquiry seems quite proper, the pale cement Jungfrau a squat, phlegmatic, and one gathers nettled in a dim corner. Of course, says Osby with a fluid passage of fingers and wrist based on the way Bela Lugosi handed a certain glass of doped wine to some fool of a juvenile lead in White Zombie, the first movie Osby ever saw, and in a sense the last, ranking on his all-time list along with Son of Frankenstein, Freaks, Flying Down to Rio, and perhaps Dumbo, which he went to see in Oxford Street last night, but midway through noticed, instead of a magic feather, the humorless green and magenta face of Mr. Ernest Bevin wrapped in the chubby trunk of the long-lashed baby elephant, and decided it would be prudent to excuse himself. No, since Pirate meantime has misunderstood whatever it was Osby said, not, of course, you've gone mad, Prentice, that wasn't it at all. What then, Pirate asks, after Osby's lapse has passed the minute mark. Ah? Says Osby. Pirate is having second thoughts, is what it is. He keeps recalling that Katya now avoids all mention of the house in the forest. She has glanced into it and out, but the truth's crystal sheets have diffracted all her audible words, often to tears, and he can't quite make sense of what's spoken, much less infer to the radiant crystal itself. Indeed, why did she leave Schussstelle 3? We are never told why. But now and then, players in a game will, lull or crisis, be reminded how it is, after all, really play, and be unable then to continue in the same spirit. Nor need it be anything sudden, spectacular. It may come in gentle. And regardless of the score, the number of watchers, their collective wish, penalties they or the leagues may impose, the player will, waking deliberately, perhaps with Katya's own tough young isolates shrug and stride, say, fuck it, and quit the game, quit it cold. All right, he continues alone, Osby lost in a mooning doper's smile. Tracking the mature female snow skin of the Alp in the corner, he and the frozen peak above and the blue night. It's a lapse of character, then, a crotchet, like carrying the bloody Mendoza. Everyone else in the firm packs a sten, you know. The Mendoza weighs 3 times as much. No one's even seen any 7mm Mexican Mauser bullets lately, even in Portobello Road. It hasn't the grand garage simplicity or the rate of fire, and still he loves it. Yes, most likely, it's love these days. You see, it's a matter of trade-off, isn't it? The nostalgia of its Lewis-style straight pull and being able to lift the barrel off in a second. Ever tried to take the barrel off of a sten? And having a double-ended striker in case one breaks. Am I going to let the extra weight make a difference? It's my crotchet. I'm indifferent to weight, or I wouldn't have brought the girl back out, would I? I am not your responsibility. The statue in wine-colored, façonné velvet from neck to wrists and insteps. And how long, gentlemen, has she been watching from the shadows? Oh, Pirate turning sheepish. You are, you know. The happy couple, Osby roars suddenly, taking another pinch of nutmeg like snuff, eyeballs rolling white as the miniature mountain. Sneezing now loudly about the kitchen, it strikes him as incredible that he has both these people inside the same field of vision. Pirate's face darkening with embarrassment, Katya's unchanging, half struck by light from the next room, half in slate windows. Should I have left you then? And when she only compresses her mouth impatient, or do you think someone over here owed it to you to bring you out? No. That reached her. Pirate only asked because he's begun to suspect, darkly, any number of someone's over here. But to Katya a debt is for wiping out. Her old, intractable vice. She wants to cross seas, to connect countries between whom there is no possible rate of exchange. Her ancestors sang in Middle Dutch, Ich heb u lieve, dan in Everswien, al werd van Fienen gouden gevraagd. Love incommensurate with gold, golden calf, even in this case golden swine. But by the middle of the 17th century, there were no more pigs of gold, only of flesh mortal as that of Franz van der Hoff, another ancestor, who went off to Mauritius with a boatload of these live hogs, and lost 13 years toting his hackbus through the ebony forests, wandering the swamps and lava flows, systematically killing off the native dodos for reasons he could not explain. The Dutch pigs took care of eggs and younger birds. Evans carefully drew beads on the parents at 10 or 20 meters, the piece propped on its hook, slowly squeezing the trigger, eye focused on the molting ugliness, while closer in the slow match, soaked in wine, held in the jaws of the serpentine, came blooming redly downward, its heat on his cheek, like my own small luminary, he wrote home to Hendrik, the older brother, the ruler of my sign. Uncovering the priming powder he'd been keeping shielded with his other hand, sudden flash in the pan, through the touch hole, and a loud report echoing off the steep rocks, recoil smashing the butt up along his shoulder, the skin there at first raw, blistered, then calloused over after the first summer. And the stupid, awkward bird never intended to fly or run at any speed. What were they good for? Unable now even to locate his murderer, ruptured, splashing blood, raucously dying. At home, the brother skimmed the letters, some crisp, some sea-stained or faded, spanning years, delivered all at once, understanding very little of it, only anxious to spend the day, as usual, in the gardens and greenhouse with his tulips, a reigning madness of the time. Especially one new variety named for his current mistress, blood-red, finely tattooed in purple. Recent arrivals all carrying the new snaphan. But I stick to my clumsy old matchlock. Don't I deserve a clumsy weapon for such a clumsy prey? But Franz got no closer to telling what kept him out among the winter cyclones, stuffing pieces of old uniform down after the lead balls, sunburned, bearded, and filthy. Unless it rained or he was in the uplands where the craters of old volcanoes cupped rainfall blue as the sky, an upward offering. He left the dodos to rot. He couldn't endure to eat their flesh. Usually he hunted alone, but often, after months of it, the isolation would begin to change him, change his very perceptions. The jagged mountains in full daylight flaring as he watched into freak saffrons, streaming indigos, the sky his glass house, all the island his tulipomania. The voices, he insomniac, southern stars too thick for constellations, teeming in faces and creatures of fable less likely than the dodo, spoke the words of sleepers, singly, coupled, in chorus. The rhythms and timbres were Dutch, but made no waking sense, except that he thought they were warning him, scolding, angry that he couldn't understand. Once he sat all day staring at a single white dodo's egg in a grass hummock. The place was too remote for any foraging pig to have found. He waited for scratching, a first crack reaching to net the chalk surface. An emergence. Hemp gripped in the teeth of the steel snake, ready to be lit, ready to descend, sun to black powder sea, and destroy the infant, egg of light into egg of darkness, within its first minute of amazed vision, of wet down stirred cool by these southeast trades. Each hour he sighted down the barrel. It was then, if ever, he might have seen how the weapon made an axis potent as Earth's own between himself and this victim, still one, inside the egg, with the ancestral chain, not to be broken out for more than its blink of world's light. There they were, the silent egg, and the crazy Dutchman, and the hook gun that linked them forever, framed, brilliantly motionless as any Vermeer. Only the sun moved, from zenith down at last behind the snaggle-teeth of mountains to Indian Ocean, to tarry night. The egg, without a quiver, still unhatched. He should have blasted it then where it lay. He understood that the bird would hatch before dawn, but a cycle was finished. He got to his feet, knee and hip joints in agony, head gonging with instructions from his sleep-talkers droning by, overlapping, urgent, and only limped away, peace at right shoulder arms. When loneliness began to drive him into situations like this, he often returned to a settlement and joined a hunting party. A drunken university hysteria would take hold of them all, out on night rampages where they'd be presently firing at anything. Treetops, clouds, leather demon bats screaming up beyond hearing. Trade winds moving upslope to chill their nights sweating. Sky lit half crimson by a volcano. Rumblings under their feet as deep as the bats' voices were high. All these men were caught in the spectrum between, trapped among frequencies of their own voices and words. This furious host were losers, impersonating a race chosen by God. The colony, the venture, was dying, like the ebony trees they were stripping from the island, like the poor species they were removing totally from the earth. By 1681, Didus Ineptus would be gone. By 1710, so would every last settler from Mauritius. The enterprise here would have lasted about a human lifetime. To some it made sense. They saw the stumbling birds ill-made to the point of satanic intervention, so ugly as to embody argument against a godly creation. Was Mauritius some first poison trickle through the sheltering dikes of earth? Christians must stem it here, or perish in a second flood, loosed this time not by God, but by the enemy. The act of ramming home the charges into their musketry became for these men a devotional act, one whose symbolism they understood. But if they were chosen to come to Mauritius, why had they also been chosen to fail and leave? Is that a choosing, or is it a passing over? Are they elect, or are they preterite and doomed as dodos? Franz could not know that, except for a few others on the island of Reunion, these were the only dodos in the creation, and that he was helping exterminate a race. But at times the scale and frenzy of the hunting did come through to trouble his heart. If the species were not such a perversion, he wrote, it might be profitably husbanded to feed our generations. I cannot hate them quite so violently as do some here, but what now can mitigate this slaughter? It is too late. Perhaps a more comely beak, fuller feathering, the capacity for flight, however brief, details of design. Or had we but found savages on this island, the bird's appearance might have then seemed to us no stranger than that of the wild turkey of North America. Alas, their tragedy is to be the dominant form of life on Mauritius, but incapable of speech. That was it, right there. No language meant no chance of co-opting them into what their round and flaxen invaders were calling salvation. But France, in the course of morning lights lonelier than most, could not keep from finally witnessing a miracle, a gift of speech, a conversion of the dodos. Ranked in thousands on the shore with a luminous profile of reef on the water behind them, its roar the only sound on the morning, volcanoes at rest, the wind suspended, and autumn sunrise dispensing light glassy and deep over them all. They have come from their nests and rookeries, from beside the streams bursting out the mouths of lava tunnels, from the minor islands awash like debris off the north coast, from sudden waterfalls and the wasted rainforests where the axe blades are rusting and the rough flumes rot and topple in the wind. From their wet mornings under the shadows of mountain stubs they have waddled in awkward pilgrimage to this assembly, to be sanctified, taken in. For as much as they are the creatures of God, and have the gift of rational discourse, acknowledging that only in His Word is eternal life to be found. And there are tears of happiness in the eyes of the dodos. They are all brothers now, they and the humans who used to hunt them, brothers in Christ. The little baby they dream now of sitting near, roosting in his stable, feathers at peace, watching over him and his dear face all night long. It is the purest form of European adventuring. What's it all been for? The murdering seas, the gangrene winters and starving springs, our bone pursuit of the unfaithful, midnights of wrestling with the beast, our sweat become ice and our tears pale flakes of snow, if not for such moments as this. The little converts flowing out of eyes field, so meek, so trusting. How shall any craw clench in fear, any recreant cry be offered in the presence of our blade, our necessary blade? Sanctified now they will feed us. Sanctified their remains and droppings fertilize our crops. Did we tell them salvation? Did we mean a dwelling forever in the city? Everlasting life, an earthly paradise restored, their island as it used to be given them back? Probably. Thinking all the time of the little brothers numbered among our own blessings. Indeed, if they save us from hunger in this world, then beyond, in Christ's kingdom, our salvations must be in like measure inextricable. Otherwise the dodos would be only what they appear as in the world's illusory light, only our prey. God could not be that cruel. Franz can look at both versions, the miracle and the hunt, of more years than he can remember now, as real, equal possibilities. In both, eventually, the dodos die. But as for faith, he can believe only in the one steel reality of the firearm he carries. He knew that a snap hunt would weigh less. Its cock, flint, and steel give him surer ignition, but he felt a nostalgia about the hakbus. He didn't mind the extra weight. It was his crotchet. Pirate and Osby Feel are leaning on their roof ledge. A magnificent sunset across and up the winding river, the imperial serpent, crowds of factories, flats, parks, smoky spires and gables, incandescent sky casting downward across the miles of deep streets and roofs cluttering and sinuous river Thames, a drastic stain of burnt orange to remind a visitor of his mortal transience here. To seal or empty all the doors and windows in sight to his eyes that look only for a bit of company. A word or two in the street before he goes up to the soap-heavy smell of the rented room and the squares of coral sunset on the floorboards. An antique light, self-absorbed, fuel consumed in the metered winter holocaust, the more distant shapes among the threads or sheets of smoke now perfect ash ruins of themselves. Nearer windows, struck a moment by the sun, not reflecting at all, but containing the same destroying light, this intense fading in which there is no promise of return, light that rusts the government cars at the curbsides, varnishes the last faces hurrying past the shops in the cold as if a vast siren had finally sounded, light that makes chilled, untraveled canals of many streets, and that fills with the starlings of London, converging by millions to hazy stone pedestals, to emptying squares, and a great collective sleep. They flow in rings, concentric rings on the radar screens. The operators call them angels. He's haunting you. Osby puffing on an Amanita cigarette. Yes, Pirate ranging the edges of the roof garden, irritable in the sunset. But it's the last thing I want to believe. The other's been bad enough. What do you think of her, then? Someone can use her, I think. Having decided this yesterday at Charing Cross Station, where she left for the White Visitation. An unforeseen dividend for somebody. Do you know what they have in mind down there? Only that they're brewing up something that involves a giant octopus. But no one up here in London knows with any precision. Even at the White Visitation, there's this sudden great coming and going, and a swampy ambiguity as to why. Myron Grunton is noted casting less than comradely looks at Roger Mexico. The Zouave has gone back to his unit in North Africa. Back under the cross of Lorraine, all that the German might find sinister in his blackness recorded on film, sweet-talked or coerced out of him by none less than Gerhard von Göhl, once an intimate and still the equal of Lang, Pabst, Lubitsch, more lately meshed in with the affairs of any number of exile governments. fluctuations in currencies, the establishment and disestablishment of an astonishing network of market operations winking on, winking off across the embattled continent. Even as the firefights whistle steel up and down the streets and the firestorms sweep oxygen up in the sky and the customers fall smothered like bugs in the presence of flit. But commerce has not taken away Von Gerl's touch. These days it has grown more sensitive than ever. In these first rushes, the black man moves about in SS uniform, among the lath and canvas mock-ups of rocket and Meilerwagen, always shot through pines, through snow, from distant angles that don't give away the English location. The others in plausible blackface, recruited for the day, the whole crew on a lark, Mr. Pointsman, Mexico, Edwin Treacle and Rollo Grost, ARF's resident neurosurgeon, Aaron Throster, all playing the black rocketeers of the fictional Schwarzkommando. Even Myron Grunton in a non-speaking role, a blurry extra like the rest of them. Running time of the film is 3 minutes, 25 seconds, and there are 12 shots. It will be antiqued, given a bit of fungus and ferrotyping, and transported to Holland to become part of the remains of a counterfeit rocket-firing site in the Reichsweissgebosch. The Dutch resistance will then raid this site, making a lot of commotion, faking in tire tracks and detailing the litter of hasty departure. The inside of an army lorry will be gutted by Molotov cocktails. Among ashes, charred clothing, blackened and slightly melted gin bottles will be found fragments of carefully forged Schwarzkommando documents, and of a reel of film, only 3 minutes and 25 seconds of which will be viewable. Von Gerl, with a straight face, proclaims it to be his greatest work. Indeed, as things were to develop, writes noted film critic Mitchell Prettyplace, one cannot argue much with his estimate, though for vastly different reasons than Von Gerl might have given, or even from his peculiar vantage foreseen. At the White Visitation, because of erratic funding, there is only one film projector. Each day about noon, after the Operation Black Wing people have watched their fraudulent African rocket troops, Webley Silvernail comes to carry the projector back down the chilly, scuffed wood corridors again to the ARF wing, into the inner room where Octopus Grigori oozes sullenly in his tank. In other rooms, the dogs whine, bark shrilly in pain, whimper for a stimulus that does not, will never come, and the snow goes whirling, invisible tattooing needles against the nerveless window glass behind the green shades. The reel is threaded, the lights are switched off, Grigori's attention is directed to the screen where an image already walks. The camera follows as she moves deliberately nowhere, long-legged about the rooms, an adolescent wideness and hunching to the shoulders, her hair not bluntly Dutch at all, but secured in a modish upsweep with an old tarnished silver crown. It was very early morning. He stumbled out alone into a wet brick street. Southward, the barrage balloons, surf riders on the combers of morning, were glowing pink and pearl in the sunrise. They've cut Slothrop loose again. He's back on the street. Shit, last chance for a Section 8, and he blew it. Why didn't they keep him on at that nut ward for as long as they said they would? Wasn't it supposed to be a few weeks? No explanation, just cheerio. And the onion skin sending him back to that Achtung. The Kenosha Kid and that Crouchfield, the Westward Man, and his sidekick Wappo have been all his world for these recent days. There were still problems to be worked out, adventures not yet completed, coercions and vast deals to be made on the order of the old woman's arrangement for getting her pig home over the stile, but now, rudely, here's that London again. But something's different. Something's been changed. Don't mean to bitch, folks, but, well, for instance, he could almost swear he's being followed, or watched anyway. Some of the tales are pretty slick, but others he can spot all right. Christmas shopping yesterday at that Woolworth's, he caught a certain pair of beady eyes in the toy section, past a heap of balsa wood fighter planes and little kid-size Enfields. a hint of constancy to what shows up in the rear-view mirror of his Humber. No color or model he can pin down, but something always present inside the tiny frame has led him to start checking out other cars when he goes off on a morning's work. Things on his desk at Achtung seem not to be where they were. Girls have found excuses not to keep appointments. He feels he's being gently separated from the life he lived before going into St. Veronica's. Even in movies, there's always someone behind him being careful not to talk, rattle paper, laugh too loud. Slothrop's been to enough movies that he can pick up an anomaly like that right away. The cubicle near Grosvenor Square begins to feel more and more like a trap. He spends his time, often whole days, ranging the East End, breathing the rank air of Thameside, seeking places the followers might not follow. One day, just as he's entering a narrow street, all ancient brick walls and lined with costermongers, he hears his name called. And hubba hubba, what's this then? Here she comes, all right, blonde hair flying in telltales, white wedgies clattering on cobblestones, an adorable tomato in a nurse uniform, and her name's, Darlene. Golly, it's Darlene. She works at St. Veronica's Hospital, lives nearby at the home of a Mrs. Quad, a lady widowed long ago and since suffering a series of antiquated diseases. Green sickness, tetter, kibes, purples, impostumes and almonds in the ears, most recently a touch of scurvy. So, out in search of limes for her landlady, the fruit beginning to jog and spill from her straw basket and roll yellow-green back down the street, young Darlene comes running, her nurse's cap, her breasts soft fenders for this meeting on the gray city sea. "You come back. Ah, Tyrone, you're back." A tear or two, both of them down picking up citrus, the starch khaki dress rattling, even the odd sniffle from Slothrop's not unsentimental nose. "It's me, love." Tire tracks in the slush have turned to pearl, mellow pearl. Gulls cruise slowly against the high windowless brick walls of the district. Mrs. Quad's is up three dark flights, with the dome of faraway St. Paul's out its kitchen window visible in the smoke of certain afternoons, and a lady herself, tiny in a rose plush chair, in the sitting room by the wireless, listening to Primo Scala's accordion band. She looks healthy enough. On the table, though, is her crumpled chiffon handkerchief, feathered blots of blood in and out the convolutions like a floral pattern. "You were here when I had that horrid quotidian ague," she recalls Slothrop. "The day we brewed the wormwood tea." Sure enough, the very taste now rising through his shoe soles, taking him along. They're reassembling. It must be outside his memory. Cool, clean interior, girl and woman, independent of his shorthand of stars. So many fading-faced girls, windy canal sides, bedsitters, bus stop goodbyes. How can he be expected to remember? But this room has gone on clarifying. Part of whoever he was inside it has kindly remained, stored quiescent these months outside of his head, distributed through the grainy shadows, the grease-hazy jars of herbs, candies, spices, all the Compton Mackenzie novels on the shelf, glassy ambrotypes of her late husband Austin, night-dusted inside gilded frames, up on the mantel where last time Michaelmas daisies greeted and razzled from a little Sèvres vase she and Austin found together one Saturday long ago in a Wardour Street shop. "He was my good health," she often says. "Since he passed away, I've had to become all but an outright witch in pure self-defense." From the kitchen comes the smell of limes, freshly cut and squeezed. Darlene's in and out of the room, looking for different botanicals, asking where the cheesecloths got to. "Theron, help me just reach down that..." "No, next to it, the tall jar, thank you, love." Back into the kitchen in a creak of starch, a flash of pink. "I'm the only one with a memory around here," Mrs. Quad sighs. "We help each other, you see." She brings out from behind its cretonne camouflage a great bowl of candies. "Now," beaming at Slothrop, "here, fine jellies. They're pre-war. Now I remember you, the one with the graft at the Ministry of Supply." But he knows from last time that no gallantry can help him now. After that visit, he wrote home to Nalin. "The English are kind of weird when it comes to the way things taste, Mom. They aren't like us. It might be the climate. They go for things we would never dream of. Sometimes it is enough to turn your stomach. Boy, the other day I had one of these things they call wine jellies. That's their idea of candy, Mom. Figure out a way to feed some to that Hitler, and I bet you the war'd be over tomorrow." Now once again he finds himself checking out these ruddy gelatin objects, nodding, he hopes amiably, at Mrs. Quad. They have the names of different wines within on them in bas-relief.
"Just a touch of menthol, too," Mrs. Quad popping one into her mouth. "Delicious."
Slothrop finally chooses one that says Lafitte Rothschild and stuffs it on into his kisser. "Oh, yeah, yeah. Mmm, it's great."
"If you really want something peculiar, try the Bernkassler, Doctor. Oh, aren't you the one who brought me those lovely American slimy elm things, maple-tasting with a touch of sassafras?"
"Slippery elm. Jeepers, I'm sorry, I ran out yesterday." Darlene comes in with a steaming pot and three cups on a tray. "What's that?" Slothrop a little quickly here. "You don't really want to know, Tyrone."
"Quite right."
After the first sip, wishing she'd used more lime juice or something to kill the basic taste, which is ghastly bitter. "These people are really insane." "No sugar, Natch." He reaches in the candy bowl, comes up with a black-ribbed licorice drop. It looks safe, but just as he's biting in, Darlene gives him and it a peculiar look. "Great timing, this girl," says.
"Oh, I thought we got rid of all those."
The blithe Gilbert and Sullivan ingenues, "those, years ago," at which point Slothrop is encountering this driveling liquid center which tastes like mayonnaise and orange peels.
"You've taken the last of my marmalade surprises," cries Mrs. Quad, having now, with conjurer's speed, produced an egg-shaped confection of pastel green, studded all over with lavender nonpareils. "Just for that, I shan't let you have any of these marvelous rhubarb creams."
Into her mouth it goes, the whole thing. "Serves me right," Slothrop, wondering just what he means by this, sipping herbed tea to remove the taste of the mayonnaise candy. Oops, but that's a mistake. Right, here's his mouth filling once again with horrible alkaloid desolation, all the way back to the soft palate where it digs in. Darlene, pure nightingale compassion, is handing him a hard red candy molded like a stylized raspberry. Which, oddly enough, even tastes like a raspberry, though it can't begin to take away that bitterness. Impatiently, he bites into it, and in the act knows, fucking idiot, he's been had once more. There comes pouring out onto his tongue the most god-awful crystalline concentration of, jeez, it must be pure nitric acid. Oh, mercy, that's really sour. Hardly able to get the words out, he's so puckered up, exactly the sort of thing Hop Harrigan used to pull to get Tank Tinker to quit playing his ocarina. A shabby trick then, and twice as reprehensible, coming from an old lady who's supposed to be one of our allies. Shit, he can't even see. It's up his nose, and whatever it is won't dissolve, just goes on torturing his shriveling tongue and crunches like ground glass among his molars. Mrs. Quad is meantime busy savoring, bite by dainty bite, a cherry quinine petit four. She beams at the young people across the candy bowl. Slothrop, forgetting, reaches again for his tea. There is no graceful way out of this now. Darlene has brought a couple, three more candy jars down off the shelf, and now he goes plunging, like a journey to the center of some small hostile planet, into an enormous bonbon, chomp through the mantle of chocolate, to a strongly eucalyptus-flavored fondant, finally into a core of some very tough grape gum arabic. He fingernails a piece of this out from between his teeth, and stares at it for a while. It is purple in color.
"Now you're getting the idea,"
Mrs. Quad waving at him a marbled conglomerate of ginger root, butterscotch, and anise seed.
"You see, you also have to enjoy the way it looks. Why are Americans so impulsive?"
"Well," mumbling, "usually we don't get any more complicated than Hershey bars, see?"
"Oh, try this,"
hollers Darlene, clutching her throat and swaying against him. "Gosh, it must really be something," doubtfully taking this nasty-looking brownish novelty, an exact quarter-scale replica of a Mills-type hand grenade, lever, pin, and everything, one of a series of patriotic candies put out before sugar was quite so scarce. Also including, he notices, peering into the jar, a .455 Webley cartridge of green and pink striped taffy, a 6-ton earthquake bomb of some silver-flecked blue gelatin, and a licorice bazooka. Go on, then. Darlene actually taking his hand with the candy in it and trying to shove it into his mouth. Was just, you know, looking at it the way Mrs. Quad suggested. And no fair squeezing it, Tyrone. Under its tamarind glaze, the Mills bomb out to be luscious pepsin-flavored nougat, chock-full of tangy candied cubeb berries and a chewy camphor gum center. It is unspeakably awful. Slothrop's head begins to reel with camphor fumes. His eyes are running. His tongue's a hopeless holocaust. Cubeb? He used to smoke that stuff. Poisoned, he is able to croak. Show a little backbone, advises Mrs. Quad. Yes, Darlene, through tongue-softened sheets of caramel. Don't you know there's a war on? Here now, love, open your mouth. Through the tears, he can't see it too well, but he can hear Mrs. Quad across the table going, yum, 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 and Darlene giggling. It is enormous and soft, like a marshmallow, but somehow, unless something is now going seriously wrong with his brain, it tastes like gin. What's this? He inquires thickly. A gin marshmallow, says Mrs. Quad. Oh, that's nothing. Have one of these. His teeth, in some perverse reflex, crunching now through a hard, sour gooseberry shell into a wet, spurting unpleasantness of, he hopes it's tapioca, little glutinous chunks of something all saturated with powdered cloves.
More tea?
Darlene suggests. Slothrop is coughing violently, having inhaled some of that clove filling.
Nasty cough,
Mrs. Quad offering a tin of that least believable of English cough drops, the Megazone.
Darlene, the tea is lovely. I can feel my scurvy going away. Really, I can.
The Megazone is like being belted in the head with a Swiss Alp. Menthol icicles immediately begin to grow from the roof of Slothrop's mouth. Polar bears seek toenail holds up the freezing, frosty grape alveolar clusters in his lungs. It hurts his teeth too much to breathe, even through his nose, even necktie loosened, with his nose down inside the neck of his olive drab T-shirt. Benzoin vapors seep into his brain, his head floats in a halo of ice. Even an hour later, the Megazone still lingers, a mint ghost in the air. Slothrop lies with Darlene, the disgusting English candy drill a thing of the past, his groin now against her warm bottom. The one candy he did not get to taste, one Mrs. Quad withheld, was the Fire of Paradise, that famous confection of high price and protean taste, salted plum to one, artificial cherry to another, sugared violets, Worcestershire sauce, spiced treacle, any number of like descriptions, positive, terse, never exceeding two words in length, resembling the descriptions of poison and debilitating gases found in training manuals, sweet and sour eggplant being perhaps the lengthiest to date. The Fire of Paradise today is operationally extinct, and in 1945 can hardly be found, certainly nowhere among the sunlit shops and polished windows of Bond Street or waste Belgravia, but every now and then one will surface in places which deal usually other merchandise than sweets. At rest, back inside big glass jars clouded by the days, along with objects like itself, sometimes only one candy to a whole jar, nearly hidden in the ambient tourmalines and German gold. Carved ebony finger stalls from the last century, pegs, valve pieces, threaded hardware from obscure musical instruments, electronic components of resin and copper that the war, in its glutton, ever-nibbling intake, has not yet found and licked back into its darkness. Places where the motors never come close enough to be loud, and there are trees outside along the street. Inner rooms and older faces developing under light falling through a skylight, yellower, later in the year. Hunting across the zero between waking and sleep, his halfway limp cock still inside her, their strengthless legs bent the same angle, The bedroom deepens into water and coolness. Somewhere the sun is going down. Just enough light to see the darker freckles on her back. In the parlor, Mrs. Quad is dreaming she's back in the gardens at Bournemouth, among the rhododendrons, and a sudden rain, Austin crying, "Touch her throat, Majesty, touch!" And Iryu, a pretender but the true king, for a very doubtful branch of the family usurped the throne in 1878 during the intrigues over Bessarabia, Iryu in an old-fashioned frock coat with golden galloons shining at the sleeves, bending toward her in the rain to cure her forever of king's evil, looking exactly as he does in the rotogravure, his lovely Rissula a step or two behind, kindly, seriously waiting. Around them the rain thundering down, the king's white ungloved hand bending like a butterfly to touch the hollow of Mrs. Quad's throat. The miracle touch. Gently. Touch. The lightning. And Slothrop is yawning. What time is it? And Darlene is swimming up from sleep. When with no warning the room is full of noon, blinding white, every hair flowing up from her nape clear as day, as the concussion drives in on them, rattling the building to its poor bones, beating in the window shade, gone all to white and black lattice of mourning cards. Overhead, catching up, the rocket's rush comes swelling, elevated express down, away into ringing silence. Outside, glass has been breaking, long dissonant cymbals up the street. The floor has twitched like a shaken carpet and the bed with it. Slothrop's penis has sprung erect, aching. To Darlene, suddenly awake, heart pounding fast, palms and fingers in fear's pain, this hard-on has seemed reasonably part of the white light, the loud blast. By the time the explosion has died to red, strong flickering on the shade, she's begun to wonder about the two together, but they're fucking now, and what does it matter? But God's sake, why shouldn't this stupid blitz be good for something? And who's that? Through the crack in the orange shade, breathing carefully, watching? And we're keepers of maps, specialists at surveillance, would you say the next one will fall? The very first touch. He'd been saying something mean, a bit of the usual Mexico self-reproach. Ah, you don't know me, I'm really a bastard sort of thing. No, she went to put her fingers to his lips. Don't say that. As she reached, without thinking, he grabbed her waist, moved her hand away, pure defense, but kept holding her by the wrist. They were eyes to eyes, and neither would look away. Roger brought her hand to his lips and kissed it then, still watching her eyes. A pause, his heart in sharp knocks against the front of his chest. Oh, the sound rushing out of her, and she came in to hug him, completely let go, open, shivering as they held each other. End of side four. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.